scared.
Are you?
You're just like, wow. I like to be up there. What you
got? Open the House Committee on Human Services and Housing on Friday, April 12th, 2013. And open up a work session. Debbie, that's when she's here for, right? On 32, House Bill 3244. Representative Boone, did you want to say anything?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 3244 has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. It modifies the age of runaway and homeless youth for whom Department of Human Services must recommend policies for system of services.
Welcome, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee. For the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32, and I'm here to support House Bill 3244.
Great. We have some people who want to talk. Do you want to say it, and we'll listen to them and see if you have anything to say after that, or do you want to...
No, I was just instructed not to say anything.
Oh. I got it.
But
yeah,
but I do. That's the shortest speech I've ever given.
I know that.
I'm glad to see that there are people behind me who are smarter than I am and that can answer your questions.
Nobody more committed than you, Representative Boone.
Thank you. Thanks for hearing this bill.
You're welcome. Marita Johnson, Mike Balter, and Doug Riggs. Just introduce yourself, please.
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Doug Riggs on behalf of the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs. We very much appreciate you taking time today, and I won't take much time. I'm here to back cleanup if necessary, but wanted to have the experts say a few words about the fiscal impact and then also the policy.
Great, thank you.
Madam Chair, my name is Marita Johnson, and I am currently the Deputy Director of Child Welfare at the Department of Human Services.
Oh, good. Hi. Welcome. Nice to see you. That's great.
Oh, we're happy I've been outed.
You've been outed, so you'll be here much more in the future.
I imagine so.
Thank you.
Okay. I just wanted to talk about DHS support of this bill. This has been a collaborative process in terms of taking a look at this bill, and we've had three amendments, which our group has agreed upon. Two of them I wanted to point out. One was we were pretty strong that we wanted to ensure that youth over the age of 18 weren't considered runaways. And the second piece was is that we wanted to ensure that services were limited up to through age 20 because DHS isn't statutorily able to provide services for children past their 21st birthday. This process isn't a fiscal to DHS because the funds are passed through us and not from us. And historically, DHS inherited this program from the State Commission in July of 2011, and we just continued the model from the Commission of taking the funds and then fanning them out to the runaway and youth programs in the state of Oregon. So then they provide the services to the youth who are homeless and runaway.
Great.
And we don't plan on changing that. There's no impact on DHS caseload because these are not DHS kids they serve. They serve other children who come to the attention as a result of being homeless and a runaway. And so there's really nothing more other than that we strongly support it.
Great. Thank you so much for coming today. And before we go on, is it just the Dash 3 amendment that you're interested in?
Madam Chair of the Committee, yes.
Yes,
that's
okay,
correct.
Thank
the Dash
you. 3. And so we all should have that. Everybody can have a copy of that? Okay, great. Mike.
My name is Mike Balter. I'm the CEO of Boys and Girls Aid. We're one of the providers of this service and helped shepherd this service from the commission when it was dissolved, the state commission, to DHS last session, and have had a very collaborative relationship with the department and trying to adjust these amendments. Obviously, for us, we'd like to serve young people until they're probably 23, and we'll probably be coming back to you in further sessions. But at this point, these are state dollars. They are, and they're coming through DHS, and so we're very happy that we're on stage with DHS.
Great. Thank you very much, Mike. Any quick questions of anyone here? Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize, Representative Boone.
It's Marita.
We have a pretty good program in Deschutes County for youth that run away. They just received a grant for $200,000 for their home, I think. Is that a problem now that you're under DHS? Is that, how does that work? Mike says he can answer that question.
Representative Wisnett, that's probably a FSBE. It's a federal grant, Family Service Youth Bureau Services, probably a transitional living center grant. We also received one of those that's not impacted by this. The age is not constrained because that's federal funds. And the federal government, in fact, requires us to serve young people older than 21.
Okay, follow up just real quick.
Follow up.
I'm sensitive to the time very much. My colleague and I tried to pass a bill about license plate and how the money was going to go to the commission system for to prevent child abuse programs. We were advised that any nonprofit money could not come through DHS. We had to establish the Children's Trust Fund to receive that money. Is that going to prevent donations for these shelters, people to donate for that purpose or for Mike you to fundraise or whatever?
Again, Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, these funds that are coming through the Commission are also federal funds. We've also asked for the governor's budget for general funds. However, this will be a different contract. So they would be commingled. We raise about $1 million that go into this service. We are a nonprofit. Okay. And so this is just another contract service like other contract services.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions? Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Marissa, I guess I have a couple questions for you. Why is it that you felt compelled to have to make sure that these weren't going to be identified as runaway juveniles? Because that's really what the statute is.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair,
you're afraid of cops, right? That's what it was.
No, well, runaways are, you know, runaway is a status offense, and you can't commit a status offense once you're considered an adult.
That's right.
And so we didn't want to set a precedent, so anybody who had a child that was between 18 and 21 would need to file a runaway report if they were absent from their home.
Follow up. Do you know where you go to to start out initiating a report like that for a runaway juvenile?
With the police.
Right. And just follow up again. Police aren't going to do anything with somebody that's 18 or older.
Correct.
That's what I guess I'm a little confused about, why you would even want to do that. I think I can speak to that with experience.
I know that, but the bill says runaway / homeless. So the runaway would be under 18. Homeless might be 18 and over.
But that's not what I heard, though.
Oh, I'm sorry. I can clarify, Chair. Vice Chair. No, we advocated for that population of children to be only considered runaway up to 18. And then between 18 and 21, that full population of children to be only considered homeless.
Okay. Yeah, I have it here.
Okay.
One more question.
Sure, follow up.
Thank you. How many other states are doing this, extending it beyond age 18?
I don't have that. Chair Tomei, I don't have that information, but I could certainly get it for you if you'd like that.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions? Representative Whitson.
Yes. So in one of the handouts from the Boys and Girls Aid, it says, this bill allows state resources to help homeless young people ages 18 to 21. The change is consistent with allowing youth in foster care to access services until 21. So am I understanding they are they are not eligible or they are eligible for foster care until they're 21.
Chair Tomei, Rep. Wisnett, we can provide foster care for children up to the age of 21 under certain circumstances.
Follow up, if I may. What is the cost per year of caring for a child in Oregon in foster care?
I can't give you that information off the top of my head. I think it's around, I wouldn't be able to give that information.
Can anybody tell me what that is?
Chair Tomei, Representative Wisnett. I want to clarify because that's my report.
Okay.
And we were using a parallel, so we're not suggesting that the homeless youth go into foster care. We're saying that because foster youth can access services through age 21.
So if a child were under 21, 18 or over, and they hadn't been in foster care, they would not be placed in foster care at 18 or 19 or 20.
Even if they wanted to?
I think it's a matter of continuing. If my understanding is that if a young person is in process, doing well, particularly around access to college, I think that was a clarification, that young people currently in the state system can stay in the state system until they're 21.
Follow up.
I don't understand then how this doesn't have a financial impact, potentially.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, these young people are not considered, they're not DHS wards. They're either in their care and custody of their own parents, mm-hmm. or they are unaccompanied minors. So these funds are coming through federal block grant. They're not coming through the normal DHS channel. So they're not DHS wards. We are providing services to them. And it's a different track of dollars.
Okay.
Follow up?
So there is a fiscal impact potentially to someone, whether it's a federal government or a continuation of some state monies or no state monies?
Madam Chair, Representative Woodsett, currently of the $1 million we provide services for this population, 48,000 comes from this funnel. The majority of those funds come from federal government, and they allow us to serve young people up to the age of 23 now. So I think there would be no new fiscal impact. We're going to serve the same young people we've been serving. We just want to allow, if we happen to be serving a young person and this money is following them through the commission funds, that they allow to continue to be in service, that we don't have to stop service to them if they're already in service. There's a finite amount of money that you're providing. So whether we spread it from young people 12 to 18 or 12 to 21, there's no difference. It's that same small group of young people who can access the service at this time.
That was one of my concerns, is that are you going to make it have less money for the younger children by extending this out to older children, adults or whatever? If there's a finite amount of money, are we spreading it further over more people and thus taking away something from those little kids or the ones under 18 that can't work or under 16 or whatever?
Madam Chair, Representative Woodsett, at this point, it's really about a continuity of service. So I think, I don't know that we are going to displace young people, because at a certain point, they'll come into the shelter, and the older young people will not be in the shelter. They will be in this transitional living service. So there's already a differentiation of the services. I think we are going to continue to raise money and seek out new funds for these kids, because there isn't enough to serve but a fraction of them now. I don't think we're serving more than 10% of the young people in Washington County as it is.
Thank you.
So.
Any other questions? Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. Can I make a comment about that? But you can tell me whether it's correct. That would be the question part of it. I really appreciate what you have to say, because we do have a limited bucket. And so if you put them more there, then you reduce what we have on the early side. On the other hand, if you can prevent some teen or pregnancies that occur as a result of them going off the cliff and not getting services, that saves more people coming into the system later. My impression is that what this does is allow the flexibility, but it doesn't mean you automatically cover them, but there might be a few that you recognize, boy, we just can't let them go right now. That would be my impression and hope, I guess.
Madam Chair, Representative Kenegar, yes. I think the fact is the goal here is that if we're successfully working with a young person and they're on a great trajectory, you have an artificial stop at 17 and 9 months and X number of days is tragic. And I think our goal isn't to shift the population to an older population, but to allow us to continue successful work.
Where really needed.
Wherever it is.
Yeah.
I also need to comment that in the homeless and runaway youth, because of their distressed condition, that the difference between a 14-year-old and an 18-year-old is very little in terms of maturity because of the disruption in their lives. There's not this gap. There's not this great level of maturity and success at 18. There just isn't. And I think there's an illusion that these young people have matured. They just haven't.
Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, I just want to maybe phrase this a little differently and think about, you know, I think one of the objectives of the state of Oregon and our communities is really to help people reach their full potential. And I think what I'm hearing is that by continuing a service for a little bit longer, we may actually then help these young people reach their full potential. And to me, that's what I'm hearing. The other part is, I remember when you first came, there was some discussion about whether it was stopped at 20 or went through the whole year of being 21, and I think this clarifies it. And it actually saves a whole year's worth of money, so that's good. Thank you.
Madam Chair, this, if I might just interject briefly, and just I think this is a really key point. There's a study that has come out in the last few years called the ACEs study, the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, and if there's a listing of, I don't know, 10 or 12 or 14 things that, you know, you can check off as an adverse childhood experience. Anything above 4 dramatically increases the risks, not only of problems in childhood, but problems all the way up through adulthood. And I've sat through a number of the healthcare committee meetings, and what you see is that a lot of the healthcare problems that older Americans face probably could have been prevented if we had understood ACEs and intervened. So there's a real opportunity among these kids in these adolescent years and that 18 to 21 year period to be able to intervene, hopefully get them back on the right track, not only for mental health issues and for employment issues, but also for the long-term healthcare costs that the state's going to be facing.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much, and I think that's all that we have speaking on this. Thank you again, Representative Boone, for bringing this to us. And Representative Gonberg, I'm ready for a motion.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd move to adopt the -3 amendments dated 4913 to House Bill 3244.
Representative Gonberg moves to adopt the -3 amendments dated 4913. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, the amendment is adopted.
And Chair Tomei, I move House Bill 3244 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gonberg moves House Bill 3244 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk call the roll, please?
Representative Gallegos.
Aye.
Representative Gelser.
Aye.
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Kinnegar.
Aye.
Representative Wisnitz.
Aye.
Representative Witsis.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Bomber.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Mr. Clement. Aye. The bill passes. And Representative, would you please carry the bill?
I'd be delighted.
Good. Thank Wonderful. You. Thank you. And thank you to those who came to testify today. Thank you. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3244. And we will open up the work session on House Bill 2639.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2639 has no revenue impact and a fiscal statement has been issued. It modifies the definition of source of income, redefines criteria for real property rental refusal of lessee. It directs the Housing and Community Services Department to develop Housing Choice Landlord Guarantee Program, creates Housing Choice Landlord Guarantee Program Fund, appropriates Housing Choice Landlord Guarantee Program Funds to the HCS, and it requires the local housing authorities to annually report information, data, and outcomes to the Housing and Community Services Department Housing Choice Voucher Program, directs HCS to submit report to Legislative Assembly Committees, requires HCS to create and administer stable rental housing program. It requires them in consult with the State Housing Council to adopt rules for eligibility determination for receipt of grant funds, create stable rental housing account, and appropriates account funds to HCS, directs HCS to report stable rental housing program status and outcomes to Legislative Assembly Committees.
And I think the amendment we're looking at is the dash 7?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. And do we have a list of people who are here to testify? No? All right. So...
The speaker.
We got the speaker here.
Is she? Oh, okay.
It's a friend of mine.
A friend of yours?
Yeah, go to okay.
Any friend of yours?
No.
No, I won't go there.
Good afternoon, Madam Speaker, Madam Chair. Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44.
Tim Inman, Legislative Director for the Speaker.
It's nice to be back. What a nice Friday afternoon.
Yeah,
good to see you all.
To have you back.
We are here to discuss the Dash 7s for House Bill 2639. The document you have, when we first testified on the bill, in my testimony, we laid out a description of the bill. In red, you see the update to reflect the Dash 7. So, just for consistency's sake, you can see how we described the bill when we were first here and some of the changes that have been made. So hopefully that's helpful. I do think the Dash 7, they've done a tremendous job in Legislative Council and Legislative Fiscal to move with how fast the committees are going. So there might be some confusion if you're trying to compare the Dash 7. Everything is in there, but just wanted to make sure you had something a little simpler to read. Since we last met, we've continued to work with the stakeholders, the landlord groups, the housing authorities, the advocates, to fine-tune the bill, and feel like we're in a very good spot, so hopefully you can adopt the Dash 7 today and move the bill on to Ways and Means. We had to clarify some language with the Federal Housing and Urban Development Department around how we would talk about how landlords, while having to accept an application, could reject an application. So you see some clarification under the support for landlords. We had to make sure we got the language right for HUD's approval. We increased the ability of tapping into the mitigation fund. Originally, it was at least $500, but no more than twice the monthly rent. We've risen that to $5,000. Also includes not only physical damages, but unpaid rent. So trying to say, we're there to back you up if you have a problem with a voucher holder in your unit. Also, wanted to clarify around the housing inspections to make sure, from the housing authority point of view, having language in the bill that would be appropriate under federal housing law, since it is a federal program. So we just wanted to make sure we weren't doing something that would get anybody into trouble in the language we were using. Under increased accountability, there was a small change there. We're setting up a advisory committee to continue the conversation within the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. This changes it and says that the committee itself, not the agency, would be submitting the report to the legislature on a regular basis. So this is just a set of feedback we've gotten from the stakeholders. At this point in time, my understanding is the different landlord groups, I'll be honest, I know they still, have concerns in the sense that they want to make sure that, they're not being put at risk, but that comfort level is such that they're okay in saying they're neutral and not actively imposing the bill. I don't want to, presuppose and say they're out there supporting it, but they're not actively opposing it. I mean, this is a balancing act. We are asking private partners to work with a program that we all need to succeed, and we're trying to recognize everyone's interests and try to make a program that works for everyone. So I feel good about where we are with the landlord groups. I don't know if anyone was planning to testify today, and if I've not captured that right, I'm happy to be corrected, but that's my understanding at this point with the Dash 7. And If you have any questions, we're here to answer them. Look forward to your support and hope we can move this on to Ways and Means with the Dash 7s. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Tim, did you want to answer that?
I'm just here to answer any questions if need be.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would you say a word about the advisory committee? I'm not remembering how or where that was made up.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, thank you for the question. On the Dash 7s, the portion that talks about that committee is on page 5. You know, in the course of the conversations with all the stakeholders, it became clear that it was important to have a mechanism to continue looking at how the program was functioning, how these changes would affect everyone involved in the program. Currently, there doesn't exist at the state level any formal mechanism to have that feedback. And so everyone's like, you need to have a group that can continue to keep the conversation going. So that's why you have a committee. It's split between, evenly split between the housing authorities, landlords, and tenants with their advocates and representatives. Talks about what they were going to do, look at best practices, be the entity that reports back to legislature on how things are working. So we wanted to formalize that this isn't a one-time conversation. This is an ongoing thing. This is something we have to continue to improve and look at and figure out how we can do the best job possible with the program.
Representative Whitsett.
I was wondering if someone could discuss the formation of the statewide mitigation fund and how much it's going to be and where the money's going to come from.
The statewide mitigation fund, currently there are some existing resources that are used for similar type of activities. Primarily, that's been in the Portland area. Those funds can be repurposed and reallocated and used for this new enhanced fund with these new triggers on who can and cannot access those dollars.
Follow-up.
Do we know how much you're going to start with in your mitigation fund?
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Whitsett, you're going to see a fiscal that I believe is not minimal, but it's incomplete and for the purpose of sending it to Ways and Means. But the initial look, the current rent guarantee program has approximately $475,000 in it right now. We estimate we might want to have a little bit more in there. We're trying to figure out how you can build a guarantee fund when the assumption and the practice that's been happening in Portland, they have a fund, but it's not really been tapped. So how much money do you need to set aside for a fund to make sure you have enough without, you know, being too liberal in the sense that you have more money than you need, it's just sitting there. So we're trying to figure that out. The current fund has $475,000 in it. So we're trying to figure out that estimation, and that's they haven't quite figured out the calculations yet.
Well, I appreciate how you've kind of created it for the application process and everything to the landlord. Can you give me, Tim, maybe, or Madam Speaker, some reasons why a landlord would deny the application for a voucher?
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Olson, the application, for the rental unit itself?
Yes.
You know, I am not a housing expert, so there are some people in the room. Anything that, honestly, is legal. So, you know, fair housing law, there are things you can look at, past rental history, things like that. Other reasons that you might not rent to someone, which are now in existence for anyone in the private market, and if they are legal and fair under the law, you can utilize those. If you want to.
Yeah, I mean, I'd just add that currently there are certain protected classes, and as long as you're not making decisions based on those protected classes currently in statute, then you're fine. The language in this bill is intended to provide further clarification about issues of past rental history and things like that.
Okay, so, Madam Speaker, I heard one thing, and that was past rental history from what I got. But, I mean, being really specific on that. Question.
Madam Chair and Vice Chair Olson, again, to some degree, we've added additional language right at the beginning of the bill. We heard early on that, well, if I have to take the application from someone with a voucher, I'm going to have to rent to them. And our position has always been allowing the application is the point. If you wouldn't rent to this person, for any other fair and legal reason otherwise, if they had or did not have a voucher, you are still free to do so. And we wanted to clarify in the bill that because it is related to a federal program, we wanted to be clear that, you know, you have to follow the law.
Exactly.
You know, you can't just arbitrarily pick something else that's not permitted under law now. So, I mean, we were trying to be very clear in the bill. In some ways, we wouldn't have even had to add some of this, I don't think.
If I could follow up, Madam Chair, Representative Wilson. On page one of the amendment, section large B, it also clarifies that based upon a prospective renters or prospective lessees' inability to pay rent.
Yes.
So again, if the voucher amount combined with the renter's means are not enough to meet the landlord's set rate for that unit, then again, the landlord can deny that tenant the opportunity to rent that unit.
Okay. Thank you.
So if I can clarify that for myself, so if I have an apartment that normally rents for $1,000, but the voucher is clear from the person's income and the voucher amount, they wouldn't be able to afford $1,000 a month, then that would be, I could legally say I can't accept you as a tenant. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct as I understand it.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Speaker, can you tell us, you originally came in at 2.5 times as far as the money that the owner could recover. You went to 5. Can you tell us why 5? Because the owners ask about 10,000, which is what the small claims court would allow as a max. Was that it? Did you realize that, and that was what they were seeking?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, thank you for the question. Well, originally, the original bill had, it was kind of like a deductible. You couldn't charge the first 500, but then the upper limit was the twice the monthly rent. And we were told, that's not sufficient. And so we needed to pick a number. And some people did advocate for higher, and we thought in terms of trying to understand an estimate for the guarantee fund and not really having any hard data on, what the average would be, we went with 5,000. We thought that seemed like a good number, and for some of the landlords, that was a fine number. Others wanted more. We just stuck with 5,000.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, if I could add to that. I think originally that number was chosen also. Home Forward, the housing authority for Portland, they have a similar program up there, and that number is set at, I think, a little bit lower. I can't remember exactly. It may be exactly 2 times monthly rent, but it was in that neighborhood. So we were trying to peg that with the existing program in existence in the Portland metro area. And then based off of discussions after the first hearing, landlords asked for more money, so it was bumped up to $5,000.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
Owning a place and finding the renters that you had a cat urinated on the carpet and had to replace the carpet and soap flooring, $5,000 wouldn't have covered my expenses on that. That's not a small, that's a small repair. I think there could be a lot more repairs. I thought that was something I was seeking in the amendments. Madam Speaker, can you discuss more about, and I see you, I'd like a question to answer, the Statewide Housing Choice Advisory Committee, that's new. Is that coming out of the Housing and Community Services Department? Is that one of their proposals? Because that's the one you're asking to be accountable for. And can you talk about how many additional FTEs you talked and repeat the amount of money in the fund that is out there now to pay owners if they have damages, please.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, in terms of the administrative support for housing and community services, they've put that we don't have a final number, but the general number was about $50,000 for the administration of the paperwork. They can contract out the administration of the mitigation fund, and they would need some support internally. We're still clarifying that, but I mean, it's like I think most fiscals you see, there's some FTE support. We haven't gotten the impression from the agency that they saw it as they had to do a whole lot of extra work to staff the committee. We didn't get that feedback from them. That might be a better question for them. But, again, that's something we'll have to clarify and work out in Ways and Means. There will be a fiscal impact. There will be some staffing impact. We just haven't knocked down the number.
Madam Chair, and the advisory committee that you said we're going to, the new, is that, did OS,
Oregon Housing and Community Services give you that? Is that going to be the new organization? You say the increased accountability in your letter says it'll be done by the new statewide Housing Choice Advisory Committee. Yes.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, this committee would be under the umbrella of the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how it sits in the bill itself. Yeah.
And finally, the amount of money in the fund now, Tim's, I think you were Tim's.
It was the current, similarly, there is a statewide fund now that hasn't really been tapped, and so this would repurpose those dollars. There's $475,000 now in that fund now. We're trying to figure out if we need more than that, trying to figure out the estimates.
Thank you.
Representative Whitson.
This is just for my clarification because we've had a lot of amendments. Does it still include, and this might, you might need somebody else besides you to help on this, Section 7, Subsection B, financial assistance with expenses found to support housing stability, including but not limited to application fees, security deposits, move-in expenses, past due rent, utility payments, transportation expenses, essential furnishings, and any other expenses as prescribed by the department by rule. Is that still in the bill?
Madam Chair and Representative Woodson, it is. Section 7 was not affected by the amendments.
Could we discuss what essential furnishings would be, and is there a limit on past due rent and utility payments that are past due?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, that would, or Witsit, would be determined by rule, and that has not been determined yet. You know, the reason for this fund is, what we heard from the advocates was, there is emergency housing out there that's very prescribed, like 1 month's rent or something. But for those things you need to move when you're in crisis or when you're trying to move into an affordable unit, sometimes it's hard to figure out what those are, and so you see a list of things here. We assume there will be a nice, robust conversation in the rulemaking process to figure out what that is. No one wants to be overly generous, but the reality is you need some flexibility because sometimes it is a past due rent, maybe it's something else, but the goal is to get someone into stable housing. So we want to be as broad as possible.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
So, we're at work session. Thank you. Representative Gomberg?
Madam Chair, are we not going to have the owners, if they're not coming back to testify about the amendments?
I hadn't considered that, but we could. Is there anyone who Representative? Okay.
Madam Chair, the question in the meantime.
Sure.
When in this process do we declare a conflict of interest? I'm a rental owner, and I feel that I should declare a conflict of interest.
I think this is one of those broad situations when probably there would be a lot of us. Is Tim still in the room? Tim, so what we're talking about a conflict of interest. I have rentals also, and I think there are probably several of us up here who have rentals. Do we need to declare a conflict of interest?
Madam Chair, I'm not certain on that, but for safety's purposes, I would suggest that's probably a good idea.
But we could still vote.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, thank you. So I'm not sure where to go. Is there somebody from the Renters Association who is prepared to speak on the amendments? It appears not. Okay. Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move to adopt the -7 amendments dated 4-10-13 to House Bill 2639.
Representative Gomberg moves to adopt the -7 amendments dated 4-10-13 to House Bill 2639. Any discussion? Any objection? The -7 amendment is adopted. Yes, we're going to take a brief pause.
which I think we approved, but we have not made the main motion.
Why don't you make the main motion?
Madam Chair, if I could just clarify, do the new House rules require the conflicts to be submitted in writing to the clerk, or does that only apply to floor discussions and votes?
It does also require that you file a statement in writing as well.
Thank you, Regina.
You're welcome.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Gunther. You want to go ahead?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would move House Bill 2639 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Gomberg moves House Bill 2639 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion? Okay, then, Debbie, would you call the roll, please?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Yeah, we have to do conflict of interest motion.
But wouldn't we do it as we vote?
No.
No, you can't.
Right now? Okay.
I declare a conflict of interest. I'm co-owner of rental properties in the state of Oregon.
Okay. I declare a conflict of interest. I also have rental properties in the state of Oregon. Anyone else?
I would like to declare a conflict of interest.
Why?
Because I am the co-owner of rental properties?
Uh-huh.
Rental properties in the state of Oregon.
Okay, thank you. Any others?
Madam Chair, I'd like discussion, please.
Okay. Are we through with the conflict of interest?
Yeah,
okay.
Madam Chair, and for the speaker too, I'll be a no vote. I think that what we're doing here could have unforeseen consequences of actually resulting in less people making their property available to people who need it. If we overtask them, overregulate them, and I'm really definitely concerned that those people could not recover actual damages that they could in court if they were not renting to a Section 8 person who would have limited financial assets to pay for that. And I'm also disappointed that the bill did not waive application to people who own one or two or a smaller number of units than the majority of the people participating in the Section 8 program. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to express my very strong support for this bill. I think that the group putting this forward, the speaker and others, have worked incredibly hard to really meet the needs of the people seeking housing as well as those offering housing. Again, there's no requirement that they have to take the Section 8. And in fact, their homeowners now have, or renter owners, have a fund upon which to draw for damages that in fact is not there if people don't have a Section 8. So I think this is really opens up opportunities for all sides. I know there were some issues that were brought to me by my own constituents about it. I feel like they've been more than fairly addressed. I'm really eager to see this piece go into place in our housing crisis.
Thank you. Any further?
Yes, sure. You know, Chair, that I'm not currently a owner of any rentals, but I was a Section 8 landlord. And, I mean, I really felt that as such a landlord, I was in fair competition with other landlords, so I don't see this bill as really changing that playing field at all.
Thank you. Any other comments? My husband and I were a Section 8 landlord, and we had nothing but good experiences, so I'm very eager to pass this bill and make sure that other low-income people will have adequate and fair housing. So, Debbie, would you call the roll, please?
Passes, and it was amended, and it moves on to the Committee on Ways and Means. With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 2639. And as I said during the brief break that we had, please look at the agendas for Monday and Wednesday. They change momentarily. So with that, any other business? Have a great weekend, and I'll see you on Monday. With that, we'll close the House Committee on Human Services and Housing.